This is American Crimes. And today, we find ourselves in America, where anything can happen. From your dreams coming true, to your nightmares becoming real. Welcome. Greetings, listeners, and welcome back. I'm so happy to be back, and honestly, being honest, as blunt as I can be, I am nervous as I've probably ever been doing an episode ever in my life. And I feel like I've done quite a few podcasts. I've done, I would say, close to 250 different episodes, give or take, and it's the most nervous I've been right now. And I'll tell you why. It's basically because for some reason you guys are thoroughly enjoying this show. I don't know why. I wish I could explain why, or somebody could explain to me why, and then I could relay it to you guys, but you guys are loving it. From one person to the next, you're listening to the show like, I don't know, like some, it's, I'm Willy Wonka's, you know, golden ticket, and you, I don't know, you're chomping it down. It's fantastic. That's not even a good analogy. I don't even know what I'm doing. But I don't know what it is. Some reason you guys are thoroughly enjoying this show, and it's driving me nuts because every single day I'm getting multiple listeners, multiple new listeners, or people are just listening to the same episode over and over. I don't know what's happening. But the most recent episode that I released about Skidmore, Missouri, was released February 28th, guys, and it has 626 plays as of right now while I'm speaking. And that might not seem a lot to the average podcast listener, but for the average podcaster, that's quite a bit. That's quite a bit for one episode in a short amount of time. And like I said, the pressure right now, the pressure's on. I feel nothing but pressure. I am nervous. I hope today's episode is going to go well. I hope I don't stumble too much. I hope I don't say a lot of the things that somebody mentioned I shouldn't say in the episode. Repeating myself, and that is exactly what I just did. It's the you know. But I'm talking to you guys, and that's another thing that this person didn't want me to say, and it's really hard to do when you're doing a podcast by yourself. I realize that because I've actually, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts that are hosted by one person, and that one person does say that quite often because they're, you know, talking to you, and that's what I do. So it's just going to be a thing, man. I'm so sorry I can't fix it, but I am 100% thankful that you guys are here. You're listening to this show. Oh my God, I can't even believe it. It's so beautiful. I don't even know what to do. I really don't. I don't know how to live up to the expectations. Does that make sense? I don't know, but I'm going to keep trying. For damn sure we're going to keep trying. And today, we are still in America, man. That's where we're staying. That's where all these crimes are coming from. You know, I got to stick in America. And you know what? I had a plan. I was going to go to Texas again. I was going to hit up Texas because Texas has done really well. The last episode I did was in Houston, and it did phenomenally well. I believe a lot of people from Texas have listened to it. I'm not sure, but I would imagine they were just curious. Like, don't talk crazy about Texas. I've never even been to Texas. I don't know if that's how they sound, and I'm so sorry. I don't know. Maybe it's like, I don't know. I have no idea, honest. I have no idea. But moving past it, I thought about going to Texas again, but in my mind, I also remembered that I was already in Texas once. I had already done a double episode of Indiana, which that's just because that was something I had found out that was pretty interesting in that moment. But I actually chose a specific case today, and we're getting out of there, man. We're heading to the East Coast. We're going to the East Coast, and I had to, because we were just in Missouri, and prior to that, like I said, we were in Indiana and Alaska, so we got to keep moving. We got to keep moving. I wanted to spread it out. I wanted to get away from, go to somewhere we haven't been, right? That's the best idea. You're not going to learn anything if you're staying in the same place, right? Seeing and doing the same things. We had to move, and we did. So we're over here, man. We're in the East Coast, and we're in New York. Oh, yes, New York. Beautiful New York. New York. That's a thing, right? I don't know. I feel like somebody sang that once. That's right. We're in New York, and we are in Brooklyn. Mostly Brooklyn. In and around Brooklyn. We're going to call it Brooklyn. Because the man that we're going to be talking about today, talking a lot about today, his nickname was actually, one of the nicknames, was the Brooklyn Vampire. Now, if that rings any bells to any true crime fans out there, you already know who we're going to be talking about today. And we're not specifically going to be looking too deep into him. We're going to be looking more into the one specific case, one of the weirder cases I've ever found out about when it comes to serial killers. You know, and we're going to explain all of it. We're going to explain all of it today. We're going to do it. But of course, we have to look into Brooklyn. And back in the 1930s and even before, at the crime rates and different things like that, that we do. You know, that's how we do it here. So let's look at New York, Brooklyn, New York, to be specific, back here in this time, and see what kind of stuff we were dealing with. Alright guys, so this is just going to be a little bit different because it is difficult to find these damn numbers. It's hard to figure out, to pinpoint it, you know what I mean? To the exact time when the specific crime I want to talk about was happening and the exact crime rates of that time. So as far as like the early 20th century, Brooklyn itself actually saw a vast expansion in the population and urbanization. Because of the innovations with transportations funded by tax dollars from New York City, they brought new bridges, trolley lines, elevated railroads, and subway lines that actually extended farther and farther into the heart of the borough. Trolleys began to traverse the streets of Brooklyn in 1890, which is kind of the beginning of Albert Fish's life, which, you know, once the ability became more convenient to travel, this man's, you know, becoming alive, coming into existence, as they would say, right? But what we're going to do here, outside of that, just the idea that the early 20th century of Brooklyn was, you know, increasing in population, right? It was increasing population, and there was higher demand for people to come and live there, and probably jobs, you know, because of the rail line, back then, think about this. Back then, when the railroad finally came your way, you knew that it was game on, right? The railroad was huge. It still is a big deal, but we're going to skip ahead as far, I don't know how far exactly this would be. It's closer to, I would say, I don't know, 2016 statistics as far as New York is concerned in itself. Just in general, I would imagine these statistics are probably per the same 100,000 limit that we always say. And I'm going to try and nail it down to exactly Brooklyn. The closest date I got in Brooklyn was not 2016. It was 1996, actually. 1996 crime rates in Brooklyn. Honestly, it's really hard not to say Brooklyn and think Notorious B.I.G., right? I mean, he's the accoutrement of Brooklyn, as well as, what's his name, Jay-Z, I think that's one, that's a pretty good one. Alright, so we're gonna see these statistics as of, I don't know, as best we can, as close as we can get it to, Brooklyn just in general, as of this date, you know, 2016, 1996, I don't know, but the crime rates, counts of theft is 35,614, counts of assault, 18,000, counts of burglary, 3,700. Counts of robbery, 3,400. And counts of shooting, 521. Now, I can't pinpoint an exact date, but nonetheless, there is plenty of housing available in these areas, and you're more than welcome to get there, but those numbers most definitely seem pretty high. And what we know about the history of Brooklyn in general, just the general knowledge of it, if you think Brooklyn, you think, yeah, gangs, man, shit's going down, you know, the mafia and stuff, right? I don't know. Movies and TV shows really paint a grim image of Brooklyn in a lot of ways. So it's hard not to think that these numbers are high, and high for good reason. But there's still people that are moving there. I wouldn't mind. It seems like a great place to live. I don't know. I guess it's just my own perspective. But this is not the crime rates in the 1930s, which is where we're actually going. Hey guys, just want to take a second away from the show to tell you a little bit about DollarBlazeClub.com. That's right, DollarBlazeClub.com is offering our listeners a 25% discount on their amazing products right now. You're looking at pre-rolled cones, lighters, stickers. They have some amazing reviews on Leafly.com. It is a legit thing. Get your 25% off discount through this show alone. It is the highest discount you can get for this product. Go to DollarBlazeClub.com right now and use promo code STAYWOKE for 25% off. And always be ready to blaze. That's promo code STAYWOKE. What's up, guys? Just want to take a second away from the show to tell you about Muslim backpacks. I know traveling is kind of inconvenient, especially if you don't have the right attire. And I'm talking not just your clothes, I'm talking all the way down to your luggage. Why not get a backpack that also transitions into a duffel bag? Head over to muzzum.com, that's muzzum.com/Seamus10 for 10% off of this amazing product. Why not travel in style? Why not travel conveniently? Muslim backpacks, the best way to travel. Visit muzzumbackpacks.com/Seamus10 for 10% off today. And now, back to our show. Okay, so Brooklyn actually has a 2.6 million people population, 2.649 million. That's a lot of people, and that's as of 2017. That's quite a bit, man. Quite a bit of people. I'm not sure what it was back in the 1930s, but I have kind of told you about, you know, the crime and all that good stuff. Brooklyn is actually named after a Dutch village. It borders the boroughs of Queens at the western end of Long Island. Brooklyn has several bridges and tunnels connecting to the borough of Manhattan across the East River. It's a huge place, lots of people. Seemingly pretty beautiful, right? It was settled in 1634. It's named after a place in Netherlands, which is Broekelen, it looks like. It's pretty weird. But nonetheless, man, we've talked about Brooklyn quite a bit. We've talked about New York quite a bit. We're going to go ahead and tell you. I'm going to get you involved in this crazy man's world and tell you a little bit about Albert Fish and who he was and his background. And then we're going to talk about the specific crime that he was involved in. Well, just one of the many crimes he was involved in. And the one that is the most fascinating to me. He was actually born Hamilton Howard Fish. Now, isn't that annoying? Isn't it annoying when a guy takes on a nickname, or a nickname that's just another name, but it has nothing to do with his actual name? Like, there's nothing about Hamilton Howard Fish that says, sounds like an Albert. No, it doesn't. Sounds like a Hamilton or Howard. Not Albert. Where does that come from? Either way, the guy was born in May 19th of 1870, and he died January 16th, 1936. He was an American serial killer, child rapist, and cannibal. He was also known as the Gray Man, the Werewolf of Wisteria, and as priorly mentioned, the Brooklyn Vampire, and also the Moon Maniac and the Boogeyman, which I only know of some of those other ones. I definitely know of the Brooklyn Vampire and Gray Man, as well as the Wolf of Wisteria, but the Moon Maniac and the Boogeyman, I don't know, never heard of them. But Fish actually once boasted that he had, and I quote, children in every state. It's fucking awful. And at one time stated his number of victims was about 100. However, it is not known whether he was referring to rapes or cannibalization, nor is it known if the statement was truthful, as you can't trust these guys, period. You know, how could you? He was a suspect in at least 5 murders during his lifetime. Fish confessed to 3 murders that police were able to trace to known homicide, and he confessed to stabbing at least 2 other people. He was put on trial for the kidnapping and murder of Grace Budd and was convicted and executed by electric chair. His crimes were dramatized in a 2007 film, The Gray Man, starring Patrick Bouchot as Fish, and it's a terrifying movie. Creepy as all shit. It's not as creepy as I'm sure this guy was in real life. Sadly, he lived a lot longer than all of his victims. He lived to be 65 years old. Son of a bitch, right? Terrible fucking guy. Really terrible guy. And I believe Grace Budd is the case that we're going to be talking about. And it's a doozy. If you guys don't know much about it, you're in for a treat, and not so much in a good way. So the actual origins of when Fish actually first became a murderer is seemingly unknown. He had actually confessed to 6 killings and referred vaguely to dozens more, hundreds even. Although the victims' dates and places were lost to his hazy memory, you know, being an old crazy man, he did confess to murdering a man in Wilmington, Delaware, mutilating and torturing to death a mentally ill boy in New York, and killing another boy in Washington, as well as many, many other things. But the most sensational murder that we're talking about here today is something that I'm just baffled by, is the murder carried out by Fish started with an abduction and the ending with the horrific slaughter of Grace Budd in 1928. Her abduction led to a manhunt that lasted for 6 years. That's a really, really long time, and full-blown dedication, so there's most definitely no hazing of the police in this one, because, you know, even, it's just crazy to think how the manpower back then was dismal at best. They couldn't have had a very deep staff, so you could imagine, you know, trying to find this girl for 6 years, just a lot of hours put in, man, no, and ending with horrible results. The police have given up hope of ever solving her mysterious disappearance until a slender clue gleaned from an anonymous letter sent to the girl's parents. It led detectives to Albert Fish. Albert Fish initially introduced himself. I was going to call him Hamilton Howard. He initially introduced himself to the Buds in a way that never raised suspicion with the hardworking family. Albert Budd, well, that's weird, he's got the same first name, that's creepy. He was Grace's father, had earned a modest living as a doorman, but it never seemed to be enough to adequately take care of the entire brood. It consisted of his wife, Dahlia, 18-year-old Edward, Albert Jr., Grace, and the youngest child, 5-year-old Beatrice. That's a pretty decent-sized family. To help his father make ends meet, Edward advertised in the May 27, 1928 issue of the New York World Telegram for a job. His ad read, and I quote, "Young man, 18, wishes position in the country," end quote. And followed by his name and address, of course. That same afternoon, a nicely dressed Albert Fish answered the ad and showed up at the Budd home in the Chelsea District of Manhattan. He introduced himself as Mr. Frank Howard, so that's closer to his name. A farmer from he claimed to be a farmer from Long Island, and he was willing to pay $15 a week to the young man. The family could scarcely believe Edward's luck and good fortune, and quickly invited Mr. Howard into the house. So $15 a week back then was a living wage, a livable wage. Today you'd be like, "Are you fucking kidding me? What? $15? Get out of here, Mister! Get out of here, Mr. Frank Howard!" Mr. Howard promised to return the next week and take not only Edward out to the farm, but his friend Willie as well. Howard stressed that he had enough work for both of the young men. Fish did not return his promise on June 2nd, the following Saturday, but he did send an apologetic telegram and arrived on Monday instead. Impressed by his manners and the Buds greeted him warmly, they invited him to stay for lunch. Fish behaved just like a visiting grandfather, you know, because he's an old-ass man. He passed out treats and dollar bills to the children. He presented two of the bills to Eddie and Willie, and while he had a prior engagement, he promised to return that evening to pick them up and take them to his farm. However, he had a special treat for the oldest daughter, Grace. If they were agreeable to the idea, he wanted to take her to a child's birthday party at the home of his married sister at 137th Street and Columbus Avenue. It's really specific. But the Buds readily agreed, and Grace left with Fish. Leaving hand in hand, still wearing the pure white dress that she had worn to church that morning, the two of them walked off down the street together, and the Buds waved goodbye to their little girl and never saw her again. Now, that's the craziest thing to me. I guess it's just the times were obviously different, and that's what makes this a very interesting American crime. It just, being a father myself, you can't help but to beg the question, is like, would you just let some strange man you just met take your child without you? Or without some other, parent? It's crazy. And that's what made me really intrigued and interested in doing this for this podcast, because would you? How could you? I mean, especially now that we kind of know better, this kind of situation seems impossible. I mean, still today we hear over and over about how somebody had tried to kidnap a kid and people stopped him. You know, other citizens stopped him from taking the kid and he was arrested. It's happened a lot. So it's like, back then, was it just easier to convince people? You know, was this $15 a week wage enough to, you know, trust this man to take your kid? It seems, I don't know. How do you explain it? How do you explain it? And then to find out that this, I mean, obviously, because he's lying, you wouldn't believe that this would happen. But when it does happen, and it did happen to these people, the Bud family, you would break. You would be broke. I don't even know. I don't even know. It's like, I mean, it's hard enough as it is to let your kid go with somebody you do trust and you do know. What about the guy you don't know? Impossible. I don't care how much money he's offering me. You don't take my kid anywhere without one of his guardians or parents, something of the sort. Somebody that will most definitely protect him and have his best interest in mind. That shit doesn't just happen. Especially these days, it seems implausible for it to go down in any way, any shape or form. No one's coming to my door, meeting me one day, showing up 2 weeks later, hanging out, having lunch, and taking my kid to some birthday party. Dude, what? Never. Impossible. But that's the entirety of this podcast episode, guys. It's specifically this case, because it's fucking crazy. I cannot believe, you know, stuff like this could happen, and did happen, and not just from Albert Fish. You know, many times this happened, but this is the most curious thing, because they just met the guy, and the parents were like, sure, she can go with you, and she never comes back. But when Grace did not return home that night with Mr. Howard, the Buds were concerned, but not overly worried. They assumed that the party had lasted a while and they had spent the night with Howard's sister. They tried hard to convince themselves of this, even into the following morning, where there still was no signs of Grace. Finally, Albert Budd decided to go to the address himself and inquire after his daughter. However, he soon found out that the address where the Howards supposedly lived did not even exist. You'd be fucking crushed. You would be crushed. Could you? How do you deal with that? This made the man's next step to the closest police station, as you would. He was referred to the Missing Persons Bureau and eventually to the veteran detective, William King. The detectives were suspicious of the situation right from the start. It did not take them long to find out that there was no Frank Howard with the farm on Long Island. This also meant that there was no clue to the abductor's true identity. The man had covered his tracks well, even going as far as to retrieve the telegram that he had sent to the Buds. That's fucking... These guys... This is what's so crazy and interesting about these guys, these killers, is they're smart. So fucking smart. Some of them so smart, it's unbelievable. To think about grabbing the telegram to cover your tracks because you had bad intentions in mind from the get. Insanity. It doesn't even seem real. It seems unreal that you could pull it off. But these guys went out of their way. You know, many of them have went out of their way and done shit like this and did it multiple times with the same result. You know, it's a horrible result. He claimed that he was going to complain to the Western Union, Bud, of course, Western Union, because it had been addressed incorrectly. This is going back to the telegram that he had sent. Regardless, King and the other members of the Bureau started a long and arduous search of the Western Union copy of the telegram. It was the only link that had the Grace's kidnapper, and three postal clerks spent more than 15 hours sifting through tens of thousands of duplicates with King before they found the one that Howard had sent. The only clue it provided was that it had been sent from an office in East Harlem. The idea of searching every home in that part of the city was first considered, which, fuck it, right? Might as well. It was abandoned as a physical impossibility. Like I said, manpower had to be, you know, very scarce back then. King then forced another slim link, a small pail of cheese and a carton of strawberries that Howard had purchased from Miss Bud. He told her that they were fresh from the farm. Investigators scoured East Harlem area until they found a delicatessen where Howard had bought the cheese, and they found the street peddler who had sold him the strawberries. So the guy's bringing gifts like that. Oh, sway me with your strawberries from the street vendor, sir. You know, for my kid. Doesn't make sense. The peddler described the man in detail, but couldn't recall nothing else significant about him. The trail also ran cold. It's awful. Like, to just not have any answers. 6 years? Holy God. That's just so long. So long to have no trace, no real evidence about it. Grace Bud's disappearance started a widespread search through New York City that fall, particularly when the detective and the family went to the media and with the story. Grace's photo appeared on the front page of the newspaper and garnered hundreds of tips. It led to investigations advice from angry and panicked public. Thousands of circulars were printed and sent out to the police departments throughout the United States and Canada, but with no results. The Buds grew more and more disappointed as lead after lead went nowhere. Soon, a few months passed, and after Grace vanished, even the most dedicated investigators, with the exception of William King, had given up on the case and considered it hopeless. King was actually already a legend in New York law enforcement circles. He was the only investigator who had not given up hope. Not a day went by when he did not think of Grace and her grieving parents, and when he did not put on at least some time into the case. Following up long shots and making calls, he never let a lead cross his desk that he did not investigate. Fucking dedication, man. You gotta love it. At one point, though, William King was sure that he was on to his man when he received a file on a gray-haired con man and a forger named Albert Corthell. That's Corthell. What a fucking random name. You know the Corthells? Doesn't sound real. He was on the run for trying to abduct a little girl from an adoption agency. King tracked Corthwell for months, chasing him from city to city across the country. He finally caught up with him and was crushed when he found out that Corthell had been in prison in Seattle when Grace was taken. So this is a real guy? He really went by Corthell? That's his real name? It's a fucking awful name. This man turned out to be one of two strong leads that King pursued over the 6 long years. Another suspect was Charles Edward Pope. He was also arrested and actually charged in Grace's kidnapping. However, Mrs. Bud, the principal witness in the case, admitted in court that she had picked out the wrong man. It turned out that Pope had been blamed for the kidnapping by his vindictive ex-wife. What a fucking bitch. That's like the worst type of person, right? Your ex-wife is going to put... What? Really? All right. That's cold. Anyways, around the same time, though, Corthell and Pope were being exhaustively investigated by the police Another gray-haired old man was arrested in New York and charged with sending obscene materials, mostly letters, through the mail. The letters were sent with fish pretending to be a well-known Hollywood movie producer. He offered large sums of money to women who might engage in sadomasochistic orgies with him. Hello, ding, ding, ding. As far as it looks, that has to be one of the worst guys. After his arrest, he was committed to a psychiatric ward at Bellevue for a 10-day observation. And while he was there, the letter writer claimed that although his friends knew him as Albert, his real name was Hamilton Fish. He is a relative of the famous New York family of the same name. You know, the Fishes. He would tell the same story again when arrested for Grace Budd's murder, 4 years later. Oddly, there has never been any reason to doubt that Fish is actually from this prestigious family stock. So he comes from something, you know, some sort of family. It's weird to think that Fish remained in Bellevue for nearly 30 days. He was polite and cooperative, and the doctors judged him as sane, although he had sexual problems that attributed to a dementia caused by his advancing age. He was thought harmless and was released from the hospital into the custody of his daughter, Anna. Meanwhile, years were passing in Grace Budd's case. Despite Detective King's ongoing efforts, it appeared that her vanishing would never be solved. Then on November 11, 1934, 6 years after she had been kidnapped, Miss Budd received an unsigned and anonymous letter in the mail. The letter claimed to be from a friend of someone named Captain John Davis. According to the letter writer, Captain Davis was a seafaring man who on one of his trips to China developed a taste for human flesh, namely, the flesh of children. The letter described in graphic detail the terms of how Captain Davis, after returning to New York, had kidnapped and murdered two young boys and cooked and eaten their flesh. After learning from Davis that the flesh of the children was good and tender, that's quoted, the deranged letter writer decided to try it for himself. He had visited the Budd home for lunch and had taken the girl away with him. Now this is one of the... It's a fucked up letter, guys. It really is. If you watch the film about Albert Fish, you can see, you know, the actor reading this letter, and it's so fucking creepy. Miss Budd sobbed hysterically as the letter went on and detailed how he had taken Grace to an empty house in Westchester, New York. He let her pick flowers in the garden while he stripped himself naked. He called her to the house, and when she saw the grizzled naked man, she began to scream. She tried to run away, he wrote, but then he caught her, stripped her, choked her to death, dismembered her body, cooked and ate smaller pieces. Bizarrely, the letter described how Grace had been killed, cut up, but went in extremes to assure Miss Budd that she had not been sexually molested in any way. And I quote, she died a virgin. The writer assured the anguished mother. Now see, for me, this kind of begs the question. I mean, all these things are terrible. But I have to wonder, is it worse to just be killed by a serial killer or a murderer or whatever? Or is it worse to, you know, be molested? I guess before you die, right? Including the two together. Is it better to just be killed or to be raped and killed? Just a question I have to ask, man. That's where my mind goes. I feel like I'd rather just be killed than, you know, both of them. It just seems so much, it's just worse. But after the horrific letters, the investigators went into action, pulling out all the stops to find out what monster had wrote the damn thing. The investigation was again led by Detective King. He had deferred his retirement 2 years earlier so that he could continue to work on the Grace Budd case. King immediately found Miss Howard's original Western Union telegram blank, and there was no doubt about it, the handwriting was the same. Howard, the letter writer, and this other guy, Captain, yeah, whatever the hell, they were the same guy. King used a microscope on the letter and discovered almost indiscernible design on the flap of the envelope. It turned out to be the letters NYPCBA. And a quick search of the Manhattan telephone directory revealed that the letters stood for New York Private Chauffeurs Benevolent Association, headquartered at 1627 Lexington Avenue. And they, you know, they went to check out this dude for information. Drivers might have tried to help him in the case. He offered immunity for theft of the letter, writing materials, and envelopes. All he wanted was to catch the sadistic child killer. After his appeal to the drivers, King retreated to the private office in the association's headquarters and hoped that his assurance would pay off. A few minutes later, a nondescript man in a chauffeur's uniform named Lee Sikowski knocked on the door. He told Detective King that he had a habit of taking an association stationery home with him and using it. In fact, Sikowski explained, he had left some of the unused notepaper and envelopes in a room that he had occupied at 622 Lexington. Detectives raced to the rooming house, but there was nothing there. King eventually urged Sikowski to think of anywhere else the stationery could have been. Sikowski then remembered that he had also spent some time in a cheap boarding house. He might have left some of it there. The address actually turned out to be a flop house, but it was there that the investigator struck gold. The landlady stated that Sikowski's old room was recently occupied by a man who fit Frank Howard's description. You know, a tall, skinny, fucking old man. Pretty distinct, you know? He looked like he should have died 18 years ago. Like that guy, yes. They carefully checked the signature in the room register, and he was convinced that the handwriting was the same as the letter writer. However, Fish had recently checked out of the place, and he was in the habit of receiving a monthly check from one of his sons. It was sent to the 200 East 52nd Street address. King was prepared to invest a few more weeks in the hunt for the killer, and so he took a room at the flop house at the top of the stairs, which gave him a view of the entrance and the upstairs and downstairs hallways. So he actually stayed there. There's actually a crazy photo of Detective King with Albert Fish because, he ends up capturing him. He waits for 3 days, and then on December 13, 1934, King received an urgent call from the flop house. He had left to return to the station and file some paperwork. When the landlady called, Fish was back. When he returned to the house, Miss Schneider met him at the door. Fish had come back a half hour earlier, and to stall until the detective could get there, she had given him a cup of tea and invited him to sit down. Trying to remain calm, King drew his revolver and walked into the room where Fish had waited. What he found was a harmless-looking, white-haired old man with a scraggly mustache and watery blue eyes. You know, a dead guy. He was sipping at a cup of tea. Detective King identified himself, and Fish made no effort to conceal his own identity. The detective asked Fish to accompany him to the police headquarters for questioning. And everything went down there, where everything in the letter was true. He did exactly what the letter states. And it's really weird because this also begs the question. There's only a handful of serial killers, you know, like the Zodiac, BTK, and Albert Fish, as far as, you know, to my knowledge right now, that these guys are the only few that actually kind of taunted the police. They wanted to be caught. They wanted acknowledgement for what they were doing, you know, to the nth degree, to the point where they had to go to the people that were their biggest, I don't know, enemies in a lot of ways, the people that could take away what they're doing very quickly. You know, they go to these guys, the police, the detectives, the investigators, and taunt them, but they also set themselves up to be caught. They want acknowledgement for the things they're doing. Why would you send a letter about exactly what you did to the family? It's already so fucked up. So dark. And then, I get this awesome letter from somebody claiming to be a captain that took my fucking kid, and you're going to describe how you took the life? It's fucking awful. Absolutely terrible. Like, already knowing that the kid's gone, already kind of blaming yourself, if not fully blaming yourself, getting a letter, you know, describing in detail how it all went down is fucking just, I don't know whatever happened to the parents, but I can't imagine that they were in good emotional state during any of this, after, before, any of it. I don't believe it. I feel like the whole time they struggled, and they probably continued to struggle their entire lives if it lasted at all. 5, 10 minutes. You know, who knows? It's fucking scary. But it is an insane case, man. The reason I had to do this episode is because I've always been just curious about this specific case and being one of those parents, putting yourself in their shoes and thinking about a random stranger somehow having the gall to spend a mere 2 weeks and 2 visits, you know, grooming this family to take their kid. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. But it is the dark parts of true crime that fascinate people, and that's what we're here for. So that has been Albert Fish and Brooklyn, New York, the Brooklyn Vampire. You know, another American crime great. Not great in a positive way, like, yay, this is good stuff, thanks, he did awesome. No, he's a bad, bad man. Terrible fucking guy. Terrible man. Absolutely awful. Alright, guys, well, that is, you know, that's Brooklyn, New York. That's Albert Fish. That's the Grace Budd case. And, you know, I have to travel around. That's what this show's about. I can't stick it. I don't like doing it. I was going to do Texas, man. I got a real crazy case out there that I'm looking at doing. So we'll be going back to Texas here very soon. I look forward to that. You know, I always look forward to... I just like it. You know, I like this show. I like the crimes. They're very intriguing. Especially the ones I've never even heard of. And that's what we really try to do. I try to do stuff that's very interesting to me as well as you guys, and I find that you enjoy it, so I thank you so much. You want to help support the show, man? You're already listening on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever. Anywhere you're listening, please leave a review. A kind-hearted review. You don't have to say a lot, man. Just say, great show. It doesn't matter. Anything you want to, man, but it really does help the show get noticed. More people listening to the show, and that's all that matters to me. I don't care about my ego, self-esteem, none of that. It's purely just to get more people listening and invested in what I'm doing. And if you've already done that and you want to do more, as I always say, you can go to patreon.com/Seamus, the host, and, you know, become a patron. You know, help donate to the show, help me get some new equipment and keep the production value of the show as high as I possibly can. And if you you know you can't do that, you want to make a one-time donation, go to paypal.me/chewed. I always try to put these links in the episode description, man. Just click there or copy and paste them. Whatever you got to do. But you'll be a hero to me forever. And, you know, I'll definitely mention you. I'll mention you in the show. Always like to do that. I love when you guys interact with the show. And you can now interact on social media, man. Go over to Instagram and follow me at Seamus the Host, or what is it, Patrick Michael Comedy. It's where I post all my comedy stuff or stand up and all that fun you know, whatever. Follow me, man, as well as the show on Twitter, man, where I post about all the new episodes for my true crime shows. Just follow at Infaminds. That's Infaminds. That's where I post for all three of the true crime podcasts that I host: Infaminds, Crime in Movies, and American Crimes. Listen everywhere, man. This podcast is available everywhere, and I love that you guys are taking to it so well. It's awesome. It just makes it all that much more fun. You know, even though it puts the nerves, it makes you a little nervous, but once you get going, it's hard to stop. But I appreciate you guys listening so much. As always, I am Patrick Michael, a.k.a. Seamus McKillian, a.k.a., you know, the hostess with the mostest. Ooh, hostess. Now I'm hungry. Thanks for listening, guys. This podcast is hosted by Seamus McKillian. The editing, production, and promotion of the show is also done by Seamus. The behind-the-scenes work, all the music, all that extra stuff, also Seamus. I just want to be sure to thank all of the amazing listeners out there. Every one of you mean so much to me for downloading these episodes. Don't forget, there is merchandise usually available for every one of the shows at redbubble.com. And you can also donate to me for any of these shows, for all of my shows, for all of my podcasting at patreon.com slash chewed gum, as well as paypal.me/chewed. Now don't forget to listen to the Chewed Gum podcast. That is the headquarters. That is the main podcast. If you're listening to this one, you should be listening to that one. Thank you guys once again, and good night.